whale of a tale.
J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon goes to Capitol Hill to answer for losses. From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Wednesday, June 13th.
Coming up, forget.com and .org. We might soon be seeing things like .bank and .music.
And it's Dallas 2.0 with some very familiar faces.
You'll hear all about it on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon goes in front of the Senate Banking Committee today. He'll be trying to explain how J.P. Morgan lost $2 billion. Dimon will argue the loss was an isolated incident and that no customers lost money. Marketplace's Heidi Moore has more from Washington.
When members of Congress grill Wall Street CEOs, the sparks usually fly. Remember 2009? Representative Maxine Waters faced off against Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis.
Bank of America, you paid yourself $30 million in fees. Why do you do that?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Or 2010, when Senator Carl Levin noted the scatological aspect of a Goldman Sachs contract.
Look what your sales team was saying about Timberwolf. Boy, that Timberwolf was one shitty deal.
Here in Washington, Jamie Dimon's testimony today is so anticipated that one veteran of Capitol Hill described it to me as Dimonpalooza. Jamie Dimon isn't just any bank CEO. Stanford Business School professor Anand Mahdi used an apt phrase.
The banker we hate the least.
Chris Payne, a senior economic analyst at Bloomberg Government, has met with congressional staffers, and he says that Dimon's rock star glow has dimmed lately.
I dare say that no one in Washington is going to be particularly sympathetic to him. I think he's going to get a fairly rough ride.
That's because everyone here is sick of sparring about the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. Payne says the political will just isn't there anymore.
Perhaps there isn't the kind of ire against Wall Street that there once was. This is just a kind of irritating blip.
It's hard to imagine a $2 billion trading loss as a blip, but Admati agrees that's all it is for J.P. Morgan, which has $2 trillion in assets. That's why she says the hearings could open the door to a larger conversation about the health of the banking system.
What I'd like Congress to be doing is asking what this means for the kind of bigger picture.
Unfortunately, with the summer recess and the elections in November, not many in Washington will be able to start painting that picture until January 2013. In Washington, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
For more, we turn to Michelle Davis, a former Treasury Department spokesperson who's now a partner at Brunswick, a communications consulting firm. Ms. Davis, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How does a CEO or really anyone else prepare for a grilling on Capitol Hill like this? Is this a toughie?
These are tough to prepare for because they're so different from what a CEO normally faces. The key thing in a hearing like this is to constantly remember that it's the senator's show, and they're there to make a point. And the fastest and way out of the room is to let them score their points and move on.
Now, indications about what Mr. Dimon will say will include some pretty big mea culpas.
Yeah, I think he's taking the right posture of not pushing back, not creating an argument. What the senators will probably want to do is look to make points about policy. The fact is most Americans don't like bankers and don't have a lot of confidence necessarily that what works on Wall Street works for them. That's the purpose of the hearing, is to create that momentum, demonize Wall Street a little bit in order to advance the regulatory agenda.
But is it fair to say there is a central point of disagreement, which is Jamie Dimon's point of view is that what happened at his bank didn't endanger the financial system. I think some of the senators are concerned that it was an indication that stuff like this could endanger the financial system.
Well, I think the system is much stronger now than it was in 2008, and we want a financial system where banks, if they do suffer losses, that it doesn't create havoc for the rest of the financial system. In that sense, we haven't seen anything systemic resulting from this issue at J.P. Morgan.
Michelle Davis, former spokesperson for the U.S. Treasury Department, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The outfit that assigns internet addresses, things like .com and .tv, plans to auction some new ones to the highest bidder. Today we're learning who is applying for .what. Marketplace's Queenie Kim reports.
Bhavendrakya is in the market for 31 new top-level domain names.
We've applied for .web, .bank, .loans, .insurance.
Drakia is CEO of DirectEye, a web services company that paid $185,000 per name just to apply. DirectEye hopes to create addresses that are more specialized than the typical .com and more expensive.
If I'm looking for a doctor, I know that an official doctor's website will be more likely a .doctor domain name.
Warren Edelman is CEO of GoDaddy, a company that registers domain names, and GoDaddy applied for three names. Edelman thinks that the internet needs more addresses, but he says that at 1,000 a year, ICANN is releasing too many, and people will be confused.
The flight will be to .com for familiarity and security.
Google seems to know the joke might be on the buyers. It applied for .lol. In San Francisco, I'm Queen Akim for Marketplace.
Did you hear the news, or maybe read about it on your smartphone? The days of one-price unlimited data streaming are numbered, at least at Verizon Wireless. The cell provider is ditching its old pricing plans later this month and moving to a new plan that caps data usage depending on how much you pay. It's just Verizon being greedy, right? Well, as Marketplace's Bob Moon reports, consumers and our addiction to everything digital are the real culprits.
From way back to the heyday of dial-up,
welcome. You've got mail.
Forrester research analyst Charles Govan says we've been conditioned to accessing the internet on our terms.
The expectation people have is that you pay one monthly fee and you use as much as you like.
Now Govan says wireless providers are caught having to renege on that long-time promise. He says they can't afford to do business that way any more than your power company could provide unlimited service for a set monthly fee. Even though Verizon Wireless claims most customers will pay the same or even less, its new pricing plans are clearly aimed at making users pay their way. Marketing Chief Tammy Irwin says cheap unlimited plans are gone for good.
The cost to build up networks to the level of performance that customers demand and the speeds that customers demand, unlimited is not a sustainable model.
Customers are bound to have trouble adjusting, though, as CNET senior writer Maggie Reardon sees it.
You don't really know how much data you're using when you stream a video.
Reardon fears some customers will be learning the hard way just how far a gigabyte will go. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Bankrupt Swedish carmaker Saab may have found a buyer. There are reports that it's a maker of electric vehicles with some investment from Asia. For more, we go to Christopher Wirth in London, who's been following the story. Christopher, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So I thought Saab was dead.
Yeah, you're not alone, David. I mean, I was at the Saab plant in Sweden last year when it closed down. And I have to say, it was really, really, really sad to see a dark factory with a lot of half-finished cars just sitting there on the assembly line. But today, a company called National Electric Vehicle Sweden has climbed into the driver's seat at Saab. And this is a company that's led by investors in Japan and Hong Kong. And it seems to think it can breathe new life into this car maker that's really lost a lot of money for decades. As for how much they've paid for Saab, well, they aren't saying.
When I think of Saab, I think of front-wheel drive, and I think of sticking the ignition key between the two front seats. What's all this talk about electric vehicles?
Well, before it went belly up, Saab did have electric drive hybrid technology under development. Previous bidders for Saab had tried to buy it, but they were rebuffed by GM, Saab's former parent company. It still owns a lot of the advanced platform technology that Saab uses. GM doesn't want that falling into the hands of another company, especially a Chinese one. But this company that's bought it today saying it's not going to buy the rights to those newer models. It's going to turn older Saab models into electric vehicles.
They're going to keep the Saab brand on cars?
Well, the Saab brand is still really valuable. I spoke with Hans Niemann. He's an auto consultant in Sweden, and he thinks National Electric Vehicle Sweden will want to keep the Saab name.
There are enthusiasts all over the world for Saab, and I think they could be opinion leaders into something new.
But David, he says there's also a separate company called Saab Defense. It makes military technology, and it has a say in who gets the Saab name and what they do with it.
Christopher Wirth in London, thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Well, David, Microsoft has just filed a patent for technology that will serve ads up based on your mood. How do you feel about that?
Cranky.
The technology works with Microsoft's video console, and it figures out how you're feeling using facial expressions, body movements, and speech patterns, and then it serves up ads it thinks you will be most receptive to. So happy customers will see ads for things like electronics and vacations. Sad customers, David, will see ads for weight loss products.
Oh, that'll cheer everybody
up. I know. It's like not helping, right?
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
TNT is among the most watched networks on cable, but its big show, The Closer, is ending its 7-year run this summer, and TNT is looking for a replacement. Tonight, it's launching a remake of the 80s classic Dallas. Sally Herships has more on the target audience.
The question is no longer who shot JR, but how long will JR be on screen? The remake of Dallas features the original actors, but it's been 20 years since the show's last episode. Larry Hagman, who plays the lead character, J.R. Ewing, is 80. J.R.'s younger brother, played by Patrick Duffy, is 63. Older fans may be excited, but potential new ones may not.
The conventional wisdom within the media industries has always been, if you want to get young audiences, you go with the youngest, hottest casts that you can get.
Max Dawson teaches film, TV, and radio at Northwestern. Two of the main draws on the new show are the hunky sons of Bobby and JR, played by actors roughly half their age.
You'll never be a Ewing, Christopher.
This is about me and John Ross.
You bring in these hunky guys and these beautiful young girls, ladies, and what have you, and that's what's going to push the show going forward.
The hunky guys?
If you look at the demos, it's certainly eye candy for women.
Tom Umstead is programming editor for Multichannel News. He says younger viewers want to see content that resonates with them, and advertisers are willing to pay more to reach 18 to 35-year-olds, who, demographically, are the biggest spenders. So Max Dawson says a relaunch of Dallas with just the original cast wouldn't cut it.
Murder, She Wrote, you know, great show, fantastic drama, Angela Lansbury, Emmy-winning performances. That was a show that was never going to be watched by many people, who weren't looking to invest in denture cream or life insurance plans or something like that.
But Dawson says trying to please all audiences can make a show seem schizophrenic. So he thinks the original cast could be just a televised set of training wheels and won't be around for very long. And on a show like Dallas, that's already known for drama, gunplay, and betrayal, it shouldn't be hard to kill them off. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
You may have experienced this. You turn on the computer, you go over to Netflix, you want to watch a movie online, you press play, and nothing. The screen reads, buffering. You wait and you wait, but who do you blame? I mean, you're thinking maybe Netflix, but what about your internet provider? The Department of Justice is launching an investigation to answer that question. Specifically, they'll be looking into whether maybe cable companies like Comcast and Time Warner are using inappropriate tactics to restrict online video traffic to sites like Netflix and iTunes.
Joining us today in our Midday Extra is Andrew Blum, who writes about internet and technology issues and just released a book about the underbelly of the internet called Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
Andrew, this can be kind of a tough conflict to understand. Would you mind explaining for us what investigators suspect cable companies are doing here?
It is definitely complicated. It's complicated because we think of the internet as a single piece. It's kind of the internet's all out there. It's all one big amorphous blob. But in fact, it's all based on these connections between networks, a connection between Hulu and Comcast or Netflix and Time Warner. What the Justice Department is worried about is that the cable companies are unfairly slowing down the traffic of the video suppliers, or they're saying that you can only download a certain number of TV shows or movies a month, and therefore you should actually be watching our own cable company's video service rather than Hulu or Netflix.
So instead of being an unbiased provider of whatever content you'd like, for instance, when you pick up your telephone, the telephone company shouldn't have an opinion about who you're calling. The suggestion is perhaps they are putting their foot out, tripping up some of the data, or perhaps favoring some content that they want to favor.
And there's all this nuance in the ways in which the networks connect to each other that's really not being discussed. And it's all about, is it too much or too little, or can we watch it or not? When in fact, everyone's trying to piece the puzzle together in a way that's going to both work and, of course, be cheapest for them.
Well, just to play devil's advocate here for a minute, I mean, data does cost money for broadband companies to provide. I mean, are they under an obligation to provide unlimited data to consumers and content providers?
Well, at the moment, the contract we have with our cable companies is that they offer us access to the entire internet, and we get as much of it as we want. Clearly, you know, that's one of the only times in life where you do get the full all-you-can-eat treatment. And what I can imagine happening is either we begin to be more limited because these bits do cost money, or there's an evolution where we say, you know, if you want Netflix to be a priority for you, then you might have to pay a few dollars extra for the Netflix package. Except that goes totally against the regulation at the moment, and it goes totally against our expectation.
And I think we should step back for a second and just think about the competitive landscape here. Let's say you want to watch a film. I could go to my cable TV provider and then buy a movie on demand from the cable company, give them my money, or I could also choose Netflix, where perhaps I'm already subscribed. The money then goes there.
And the piece that I like to think about isn't are the tubes clogged from your house to your cable company's office, but what about the connection between your cable company and Netflix? Is that clogged? Is that the weak link? And who's responsible for upgrading that link?
Andrew Blum is the author of Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet. Andrew, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Americans spend an average of $1,100 a year on clothes. That's less than a laptop. And a lot of that is spent on so-called fast fashion. That's super cheap, disposable clothes in the latest styles. That's the subject of Overdressed, a new book by Elizabeth Klein. I caught up with Klein in New York's Fashion District, and we began the interview near a Kmart. A shopping trip there was part of what inspired her book.
In the summer of 2009, I was actually in a Kmart in Astor Place, which is in Manhattan, and walked in and saw that a pair of shoes that I liked was on sale for an astonishing $7 a piece, and I ended up clearing the entire store out of my size. So I actually bought 7 pairs of shoes that day.
And what happened to the shoes?
Oh, you know, they fell apart within a couple of weeks. And I think that actually they went out of style before I could wear them all. So I've still got a couple of pairs clogging my closet.
How did you get from there to wanting to write this book? Because it sounds like you're consuming the way that a lot of us are right now.
Right. I started looking into it and realized that Americans are now buying a little over 1 garment per week. So it's not just me. I think that most Americans are trapped in this cycle of buying a lot of clothing for very little money. And I really just wanted to delve into why that is and what's happened in the fashion industry that's created this situation.
And it does seem, though, like especially right now, since the recession, that there has been such a huge focus on sales and markdowns and fashion being cheaper than ever. I mean, how does that sort of affect the industry right now?
People should be looking at clothes as an investment. I think that that's what's different about this recession is that you would think that people would say, I actually want to spend my money on something that's going to last. But instead, it's made us just more even deal conscious, and we have become even cheaper. And I think part of the reason why is because we have really killed off the middle market of the fashion industry over the last 10 to 20 years. So I see where consumers are coming from because there aren't a lot of options out there anymore.
What would that mean for consumers? Like if someone's maybe interested in changing the way that they shop, what's a good way to start?
Well, there are so many different things. You know, just a handful would be supporting local designers. Designers, when they're starting up, honestly, they don't have the capital to produce overseas. So a lot of them are producing in our communities. So support them, help them thrive. I would also say that people should use their tailors and their seamstresses in their community. Get your shoes repaired. Take care of what you own. And then lastly, I would say, take that $1,100 a year that Americans spend on average on clothes and buy less, but just invest your money in things that are a little bit better made.
And finally, Father's Day, a time for companies to commission studies so they can get their name in the news. To wit, Insure.com says stuff dads tend to do in the home is worth $20,000 a year. Stuff moms do in the home, $60,000. Or if you prefer, salary.com, which finds the dads sharing the load a bit more, saying we do $36,000 worth of stuff. Come on, my jokes around the dinner table are worth more than that.
I think that's subjective, David.
In New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.